Okay, let's go ahead and start our apologetics teaching. Last week, we were talking to you about evidence for the resurrection. And so what you see on the screen right now is, it's really, you know, that's what we're going to get to tonight after we finish the evidence for the resurrection. But I gave you 2 points, you know, to start with. The fact that it's really undisputed, we establish that Jesus died on the cross. He was crucified. There's really not any legitimate debate that Jesus was not crucified. And that he was buried, you know, in a tomb. And we ended last week with the fact that, you know, Joseph of Arimathea, you know, choosing a story like that is so, you know, why would you choose that? Somebody that's not going to testify to that if he's one of the leaders of the people. He was an undercover disciple. You know, the facts and the details they put, you know, the fact that, you know, they refer to him made it unlikely. And then we know historically and even in the Gospels, which is history, we established that last week, that we do consider this the inspired Word of God, but they are also at the same time historically written books. I mean, the book of Exodus is a inspired book as far as we're concerned, but it's the history of the Exodus of Israel, you know, their time in Egypt and then their time, you know, exiting out of Egypt and across the desert to the promised land. And it ends on the cliffhanger, yeah. You know, ready to go across. And then it picks up, you know, in Joshua chapter 1, you know, crossing over into the promised land. And so it is history, but there's other historians that wrote about it, as we shared, that clearly established that Jesus was buried, you know, that the Jews themselves claim that his body was stolen. Romans claim that. The fact that they say that establishes that he was buried. So he died and he was buried. They don't bury living people, so he didn't swoon. We dealt with all of that he actually died and that he was buried. So this week, I just want to just wrap those thoughts up with 2 other facts, because these 4 facts are the basis for our Christianity. Fact number 3 is that on multiple occasions and under various circumstances, different individuals and groups of people experience the appearances of Jesus being alive from the dead. And so that's a really important thing, you know, for us to realize that he was witnessed of having rose from the dead by a number of people under different circumstances, individuals, small groups of people, and even a large group of people. And they had these different experiences. And so when people try to challenge that, the biggest one people will say is, well, it was like mass hypnosis or, you know, mass, you know, they'll say that even today, a mass hysteria, mass emotional influence. And so you can convince people. They cannot, you know, when you talk about hypnotism and everything else, that doesn't happen with a whole audience. You know, they're zeroed in on individuals. Mm-hmm. Big groups of people do not get mass hypnotized, but they'll argue and say things like, yeah, but at the same time, they can get mass, like, brainwashed and things, and they'll refer to, like, Hitler, who was a very charismatic individual, and I mean charismatic by dynamic speaker that could get people emotional and everything, not as a positive. In his case, it was negative, but using that personality type, that he was able to make his speeches and stir people and get them, you know, believing a certain thing. And so they'll try to say stuff like that. But he didn't get to cause them to have an experience, you know, he just worked on them to develop an animosity, eventually a feeling of superiority and hatred to the Jewish people and others. He otherized people. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just the Jews, but it was primarily Jews. But he hated African American, well, he's not African American, black people. Yep. You know, they weren't African American, called African Americans back then, and you know, but the black race, you know, he would call them the mongrel race and that sort of thing. And so others, if you weren't an Aryan born individual, then you were inferior. And but he worked on and developed their prejudices and things. Mm-hmm. He didn't cause them to have a mass event where they pictured something that didn't happen, mm-hmm. and he convinced them of that. He persuaded them into the things. And that's the difference. So they'll try to use that, but nobody's ever been able to accomplish causing people. You can hypnotize somebody, and you can, you know, use magic, you know, where you can cause people to think they're seeing something that they're not seeing in a group, but they don't have an experience of something. You may say, oh, I saw that, but Jesus had interactions. Mm-hmm. You know, a magician trying to cause a big group to see something. I saw him disappear. You know, I saw that. I don't know how they did that. Your mind's telling you, mm-hmm. I know it's not real. I don't know how they did it. I mean, I'm the same way. I look at it. But if you study like brain games and things, they talk about how it's our brain is wired to process one thing. And so what they call sleight of hand, what they do, or misdirection, is they get you to think, and your mind will do that. It's hard to get your mind not to do that. So that's why a big audience, even a TV audience, can watch America's Got Talent and say, how did they do that? Because they know the way the mind is figured, and they study that science. And so they'll do something to cause your mind to get fixated on that, and they'll do the other thing. I mean, they can have somebody, they've shown it on the Brain Games television episode, uh-huh. where somebody can just walk right across your path and you don't see it. Wow. Or somebody can change, go below the counter and another person get above the counter, and they're a totally different person and the person doesn't realize it.
Wow.
Your mind works a particular way. And it has to process this, and while it's processing that, you can do other things, and the mind doesn't even realize that. Okay. That's why I tell my son all the time, focus on the road, focus on this. It's first and foremost who's in front of you, you glimpse, because he's learning. And, you know, the other day, it was like, okay, we started to drift. I'm like, son, you know, and because it was raining, and here we're going, and it's like, well, I was checking the speedometer. I was checking this. I'm like, there's brakes, and you stop. You know, and it's like, I'm like, priority number one, what's ahead? You glimpse at the speedometer, back to what's ahead. You glimpse in the rearview mirror, back to what's ahead. You have to, because you can only process one thing at a time. You can't do those multiple things, even though they're all important. You have to always keep your priority of this fixation point. And that's what, and we all know that about driving. We've all learned that, you know, and we know the quick look, you know, and everything. When they're first learning, you tell them, look over the shoulder, they're like, you know, and so it's training, because our minds work a certain way. Okay. So there's that. But it's almost universally acknowledged that the followers of Jesus Christ experienced appearances of Jesus being alive after being dead, that multiple people made that claim. So just a couple points on that. The list of eyewitnesses to Jesus' resurrection, quoted by Paul, by the way, in 1 Corinthians 15, 5 through 7, I don't have a, well, I can turn Easy Worship on. Let me pop that verse up for you. But let me finish this, and then I'll pop the verses up there for you. That Paul refers to these witnesses, and we referred to them last week, but we'll pop it up there again. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and then verses 5 through 7. I can't believe Jane doesn't control this for me, so I have to do everything. And she's probably enjoying every second of it. But but as you can see on the screen, it says that, and that he, being Jesus, was seen by Cephas, that's Peter, then by the 12, and after that, he was seen by over 500 brethren at once. And so it specifies this mass crowd of 500 people. And then it says, of whom the greater part remained to the present. When you give that kind of detail, then there's multiple witnesses to this event. You can't make this story up. It won't. It will be refuted, because at the time this was written, people that try to say that the accounts of Jesus' resurrection were written in 200 BC to or 200 AD or 300 AD, no, you know, right here. To make that claim, if that wasn't true, that the majority of people were still alive, it'd be easy to discount that lie. Because if it was written and that all of a sudden appears in that time, then they're like, hey, no. Mm-hmm. So it was it easily be able to refute that. And if it didn't happen, if you acknowledge that it was written at the time where people were still alive that had witnessed the resurrection of Christ, the majority of them, you know, the greater part is the majority, the bulk of them, that even if you acknowledge that it was written, then you got to recognize the impact of that, because all you have to do is say, you know, show us the evidence. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have to do that, because those people were easily seen. You know, people were telling that story. The gospel was spreading. People were being added to the kingdom because people saw. And they did, in this appearance of Jesus to about 500 people, it wasn't just, oh, I saw him disappear. It was him speaking to them and saying, go into all the world and preach the gospel to all nations, discipling them and making them disciples and baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit. They were hearing him, listening to him. That was his great commission before he left, but he was preaching to them, teaching to them, encouraging them, and then challenging them and giving them a commission. And so it was an interaction with them, and it'd be so easy to refute it. But it says that the greatest part of them remained to that present. It says, but some have fallen asleep. There's some of the witnesses that have died at that point that Paul wrote that, about 50, you know, or 68 AD, you know, 20, 30 years after Jesus had died and rose again. But then it says, after that, he was seen by James, and then by all of the apostles. And when it says he was seen by James, that's talking about his brother. And so an interesting thing about that is that he has multiple resurrection appearances. There's independent testimony available to everybody that he rose from the dead, but not just the apostles, above 500 people. So it wasn't, you know, a conspiracy, if it's going to work, the smaller number that you have in your conspiracy, the greater opportunity for it to happen. When people, you know, all these conspiracy theory people that, you know, say, oh, this all happened and it's a massive cover-up. It is hard to have a government cover-up or, you know, a corporate cover-up to involving a massive number of people, because you will have detractors. You'll have the whistleblower, mm-hmm. you know, that'll come out and say something about it, that this didn't happen, and it can get exposed. It's hard to keep a lie alive. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the more people involved, the more difficult. So it, you know, if you're going to do it, it might be just the 12, you know, the 11 that were remaining, you know, but they go beyond that and say above 500 people. And so, so just know that these multiple experiences happen, and it was by Peter, but then it was by the 12, and then it went on to a bunch of people, you know, that Peter, it talks about his independent interaction with Jesus in Luke. Then the 12, it talks about witness the 12 appearing, him appearing to the 12 in Luke and in John, two historical references. And then the independent witness to the Galilean appearances is Mark, Matthew, and John. And when it talks about the women who saw him, Matthew and John. So even multiple historical references as well as multiple people being referred to. You just don't get a conspiracy put together like that. Mm-hmm. So it gives weight to the and credibility to the belief that he rose from the dead. But here is something that's interesting, that it says that he was, after he was seen by all them, he was seen by James. Jesus had four brothers. Mm-hmm. You know, still shocks a lot of our Catholic friends when you tell them that Jesus had four brothers and at least two sisters. Mm-hmm. They have a shock that Mary had other children because she's the eternal virgin, the blessed virgin. And I grew up Catholic, and if you did, then you know, you understand. It says she did not know Joseph.
That's right.
Before Jesus was
That's
born.
Right.
But after Jesus was born, they did know each other intimately, mm-hmm. and they had four brothers. And the four brothers, the reason why I know they're four is because they're named, and it's mm-hmm. James and Jude, and Joses, and I'm going blank on the fourth one.
Judas.
But yeah, Jude. There four of them are named, and then it says, "And are not his?" It named his brothers, and then it says, "Are not his sisters?" His brothers are amongst us, names them, and then says, and not are not his sisters amongst mm-hmm. us. There may have been 30 sisters, exaggeration. There may have been five sisters, but there's at least two because it's plural.
Yeah.
It didn't say his sister. Mm-hmm. It said his sisters are amongst us. So he could have had anywhere from two up to however many they had. So he had siblings, half brothers and sisters. His biological, so to speak, not biological in that sense, but in that sense it is, you know, miraculously. Mm-hmm. Father is God, but his earthly father was Joseph. And so these were the children of Joseph. And that makes them a half sibling, even though Mary didn't have multiple spouses. You understand how that works, mm-hmm. you know, because only Jesus had a different father than those at least six other siblings. And it says in the scriptures that his siblings didn't believe in him. It talks about that in the Gospels. Now, if that wasn't true, you're not going to make up that. You know, family disagreement on that level, mm-hmm. you know. But it says that they thought he was out of his mind.
Yeah.
The King James says they thought he was beside himself, that he went mad. That he was becoming a cult leader or something like that, you know. He's just, and they rejected him. They didn't believe in him because they grew up with him,
mm-hmm.
and they might have had. I've always talked about this. They might have had ingrained animosities toward him because. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine being the younger sibling of a perfect human being? The parents are like, "Why can't you be like your brother Jesus?" They go to school. "Why can't you be like your brother Jesus?" You know, he was perfect. He never sinned. He never did anything wrong. Mm-hmm. So when you're compared to a sibling that has great accomplishments, it's a threat. Can you imagine being the sibling of Jesus? So they had some animosity and things like that. And they saw him growing up play games, do chores, do normal things, you know. And so for them to picture him because of that familiarity of just growing up with him, they slept maybe in the same room, in the top bunk, bottom bunk. It's like, yeah, he's different, but you know, but then all of a sudden, you know, to be like God and doing all this, they just rejected him. And so when Paul talks about James, they're talking about someone who had rejected Jesus. And it doesn't say it in this recitation of the different people, but Jesus not only had James come around, and it names all of them, the siblings came around after he died. Jude is the brother of Jesus. The book of James and the book of Jude are written by Jesus's brothers. And they say that. James, the brother of the Lord. Okay. But it says James, the servant of the Lord, before brother, mm-hmm. recognizing he's my Lord. But he is my brother. Yeah. But he put first things first. Jude, same way. And so when you read the salutation in the book of James and in the book of Jude, you see that. This goes on to say, after that he was seen by the apostles. And then in verse 8, it says, last of all, he was seen by me as one born out of due time. Jesus appeared to the apostle Paul after he had rose in and ascended into heaven. But he came and he appeared. And Jesus has made those appearances like that on rare, rare occasions. But Paul testifies of that. All of these things are powerful because James and Jude were non-believers. Mm-hmm. But not only did they become believers, but historically, it tells us that the unbelief of his family had changed to becoming faithful followers. And listen to this. It's indisputable that James and his brothers did become active Christian believers following his death. James was considered an apostle and eventually rose to the position of leadership in the Jerusalem church. And you can see that in the sixth chapter of Acts, by the way, when they have the big council, you know, or was that six? I think it was the sixth chapter. And they're making it, might have been a little bit later, but they're making a big decision about what Gentiles had to do. And James rose up and he settled it. He was the pastor of the mega church in Jerusalem. And so James got up and he spoke with authority as the pastor to wrap it up and come to a conclusion. And so he rose to that position of leadership in the Jerusalem church. You see it in the book of Acts. And according to the first century Jewish tradition, Jewish historian Josephus, Flavius Josephus that we mentioned, James was martyred for his faith in the late AD 60s. And so he was willing to die for his belief in the lordship of his brother, who he didn't believe in, and there was an animosity in the past. But he came after his death mm-hmm. to a place where he not only believed so much, he believed so much he was willing to die and not renounce that. Most of us have brothers. What would it take you to be convinced that one of your siblings, your brothers, or even your sister, but if you have brothers, I have two sisters, what would it take for you to be convinced that one of them was God? That's what happened to Jesus' siblings.
Wow.
They grew up with him. They had the more familiarity with him than anybody in his own hometown. They, as a hometown who knew him, had familiarity with him to the degree that he couldn't even do major miracles there. Imagine in his own house. Yeah. What would it take for you to believe? But that happened in their life. James was willing to die for it, and it happened after his death. He had to have risen from the dead. That's a powerful evidence. Would you be willing to die for the belief that your sibling? I'd die for my sibling. You would too. But that's not what's happening. They wasn't dying for them. Jesus was dead. Mm-hmm. They died for the belief that he rose from the dead.
Yep.
But his tradition says that not only, as a matter of fact, a guy named Gert Demann, a German critic of the resurrection, admits. He was a critic of the resurrection, but he admits this. It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death, which Jesus appeared to them. He had to give in and acknowledge that. That's where J. Warner Wallace came. Looking at these evidences, uh-huh. a honest person will come to the point and say, these experiences had to be real to them. They would not have had so many people die for this. You know, we dealt with that before in the recent messages, that yes, you do have people who will die for their belief in other religions, but not in mass.
Yeah.
multitudes of people died for their faith. Mm-hmm. Buy the book, Fox's Book of Martyrs, and you'll be amazed at the history just in that first couple centuries or so of all the martyrs that happen. It just amazes you. Fact number four. So you have all of that, the multiple appearances. And then fact number four, the original disciples believed that Jesus was risen from the dead despite their predisposition to the contrary. So we know that Jesus did die. Mm-hmm. We know reasonably that Jesus was buried, which confirms his death, but that he was buried because of all of the evidence on that. And we know that he rose from the dead based on all of these witnesses. Or we can say we can be very confident in it. It's the logical conclusion. You have that many witnesses, that's a slam dunk in a trial. So the fourth fact is that the original disciples, they believed that he was risen from the dead. But you got to understand what makes this a powerful argument for the resurrection is that their predisposition would to not believe that. Here's some basic things. I didn't plan on taking this much time, but this is powerful stuff. Number one, their leader was dead. A number of them witnessed it. These crowds of people saw him die. Mm-hmm. If you saw somebody that was brutally, killed, executed like that, it's hard to believe that they're alive. You know, Jesus raised people from the dead that mm-hmm. had just died and everything. I mean, Lazarus was a big deal. It was a three-day thing. Mm-hmm. But he was sick and died, and they could, have all their different thoughts on that. But they saw him crucified. And so to see someone dying, that's tough. And as Jewish people, they did not have a belief in people dying and rising again. Uh-uh. They had a belief in the resurrection, but that was a future resurrection of spirit, not a bodily resurrection. Their religion did not believe in the bodily resurrection. And so the Messiah was supposed to throw off the enemies of Israel, but this person who they believed was the Messiah died. So remember I talked about the mountaintops of prophecy, that, when you look at mountaintops, there's the valley of the church age in between, mm-hmm. and the prophets talked about the suffering Messiah. But everybody was looking at this tall mountaintop of the end of the age, of the victorious Messiah that's coming on a white horse with 10,000s of his saints and is going to defeat the armies at Armageddon and throw Satan in a pit for 1,000 years. And then he's going to defeat him and cast him into the lake of fire forever. They're seeing victorious Jesus, and they were missing the suffering Jesus, because it was hard to imagine the Messiah suffering like that. Now, we see Isaiah 53, but it all happened. So we see the perspective of having that, see, here we see it like this. Uh-huh. We know the story. We see the suffering Messiah prophecies. We see the church age, and we see what's to come, the mountaintop here. But see, when you turn that photo, that image, that painting like this, all they could see was the mountaintops. They didn't see the church age. Wow. And they were overlooking the suffering Messiah. So that's why the Jewish leaders rejected Jesus. Because it was like, this isn't the Messiah is going to throw off Rome. He's going to conquer, and he's going to rule the world. And he wasn't doing that with Rome. And so they were saying he can't be the Messiah. And so their predisposition is that, he died. He didn't defeat Rome, didn't set up that kingdom. So he must not be the Messiah. That would be their conclusion, their predisposition. Number two, according to Jewish law, Jesus' execution as a criminal showed him to be a heretic. He died as a heretic, a blasphemer. a man that was literally under the curse. And we know in Galatians chapter 3, verse 13, it references this. Let me just pop that up there for you since I'm able to. Whoops. Delete the 1 Corinthians first. Why is it not taking that away? Yeah, I'm gonna force you to learn. It's harder, but it's better. The media shout.
She didn't say nothing, did you?
Okay. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, "Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree." Deuteronomy 21:23 says that. That you're cursed. And that's what Galatians is telling us. So Paul came to know that after Jesus appeared to him, and the disciples learned that. But understand, at the time, they see him die in crucifixion, mm-hmm. hanging on a tree. That's a curse. Mm-hmm. And he died as a condemned heretic, a guilty person. So the catastrophe of the crucifixion for the disciples wasn't simply that Jesus was gone, but that he was crucified, you know. And in effect, the Pharisees were right all along because of it ending that way. Mm-hmm. They were in a state of shock.
Yeah.
So their inclination would be not to believe this. Number three, Jewish beliefs about the afterlife, I mentioned this a moment ago, preclude anyone's rising from the dead to glory and immortality before the general resurrection at the end of the world. The Pharisees believe, you know, Jesus, there was that deal where Jesus kind of used that belief when the Pharisees and the Sadducees were trying to challenge him. And, you know, he's like, you know, the Pharisees believe in the resurrection of the dead, but you Sadducees don't. Remember that? Mm-hmm. It's because Sadducees didn't believe in the end time resurrection, but the Pharisees' belief in the resurrection was an end time resurrection, that it'll be in the afterlife at the end of the world. And so they didn't believe in that. So that went against their belief system. But despite all this, the original disciples believed in and were willing to go to their death for the resurrection of Jesus. So only his appearances could have brought them to a point of getting past all those predispositions and beliefs mm-hmm. to accept it. And so this is just another evidence, because it just doesn't make sense. If you're making something up, why would you do things that go just smack in the face of everything that they believed, you know? So the question is, what's the best explanation for these four facts? Jesus died. Mm-hmm. No question, he was buried. There's so much evidence for his resurrection, and by witnesses, but also by the explanations of it goes against their natural inclinations and predisposition. If you're going to deceive people, you're going to appeal to what they're predisposed to. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen maybe if you've studied it like I have, study cults, you know how they work, but it's been portrayed on television shows and in movies before that what a cult leader does is they find weak people mm-hmm. who have a predisposition to giving themselves to the belief system of the cult. So they've got family problems, they're alienated, and so they'll prey on the young, and you know, and you, have you seen that portrayed where, you know, we love you. You can belong to us. Uh-huh. Gangs do that, even not just cults, but absolutely. Gangs do that. That sense of belonging. Mm-hmm. The devil uses bars where people go, you know, where everyone knows your name. And so people mm-hmm. go, and it's their church, it's their sanctuary, it's where people know you, and there's family, there's interaction, mm-hmm. because we're created to have interaction. And so Satan will use that to draw people who feel alone otherwise. So you can see people's predisposition in their weaknesses to go into that. So if you're developing a false thing, why would you do it against all of their predispositions? And yet, you know, in addition to these four main facts, in the resurrection, the appearances, amongst many of the people who believed in the resurrection, even willing to go to their deaths over it, was, if you read the Gospels, and you are reading, we read John and refer to it, Matthew, you know, we're on, you know, Matthew 6 today, well, we're on 5 today. I'm thinking 6 already, because my chapter's on 6 because I read 5. And so we read 5 today, we're on 6 tomorrow. And we're going to see this, that a great many of the religious leaders, the priests, the Pharisees, Sadducees, they began to believe in him. Boy, that's powerful. Mm-hmm. How hard is it for you to leave a denomination and the beliefs you had and go into another one? I mean, and fully embrace it. How many of you came out of a denomination like I did? Did it take a period of time to move out, like, a, you know, your whole life is your belief systems here, and you've got this column? It didn't just go like that, did it? Things came in and just moved and began to replace that till that falls off. I mean, I just had I think my mom and I talked for 3 hours yesterday, you know, marathon call. She had so much she wanted to talk about, questions about the Bible and all kinds of things. And so it was longer than normal call. And in that, you know, a lot of the Catholicism of her life comes out. And so she's doing this Bible study that I'm thinking, I'm not going to tell you who put the Bible study together, you know, well-known Bible teacher, and she's doing this through a group in her church, and it's like, you know, I mean, that's Bible college stuff. There's, why do you have to know how many columns were in the temple, and what are the measurements of the Ark of the Covenant? And she's like, there's 100 questions between, and I'm like, you know, getting the basics of that, I'll teach that and refer to that God's detailed, he's specific, and use it for the spiritual truth to it. But what good is that doing you? Because she's like, well, what is the answer to that? They're asking, I'm like, where's the spiritual, what is God trying to say to me? You know, it's like you're trying to fill the head, and so, you know, I slip out a couple of times. I just don't get why they're even asking you that stuff, you know, for what it's worth. But, you know, but let me help you, you know, talk to you. But in that, you know, she's studying, and it's the tabernacle and the veil and the Ark of the Covenant and all this stuff. And so as I'm talking to her about it, you know, she says, boy, that's just like the Catholic Church, because they were talking about the incense. Did they pour the incense on? I'm like, no, incense is smoke. Oh, yeah. You know, so she's like, yeah. And so that would be a false. You know? And so so that's kind of question. Did they pour the incense on over the, you know, thing? And it's like, no, the incense they wait, you know, is it's smoke. It goes up, like, and it's a symbol, like the prayers of the saints and all. And, you know, that's what's important, you know, and true, false, this, that, and the other. And so so we're doing that. But that triggers, because the Catholic Church adopted some Old Testament Hebrew type things and then created a lot of doctrinal and traditional things that just, they came up over the millennia, you know, of things that aren't biblical. And I'm, you know, always transparent and honest and say, well, that's not a biblical thing. And but she's seeing that, and so it causes her to connect to that. And then her heart, you know, you can feel that tugging, and, you know, and it's like, because she'll still go to the Catholic Church sometimes, but she's primarily in a Bible-believing church. It's not Spirit-filled, but it's a Bible-believing church where she's learning a lot, and in a tremendous family of believers and great friendships that God's blessed her with and all. And she feeds on a lot of Pentecostal full gospel stuff on TV and all that. And so she's learning all that at home. So she's going for the gusto on everything. but that Catholicism comes out. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I for when I first came in, I would catch myself. They'd say, "Let's pray in the name of the Holy Spirit." You know, you saw the halftime show. Bless you, God bless you. You know, when he's talking about the Catholics that were there, because you know we did that. We just it was our natural thing. And when I would go back to a mass for a funeral or a wedding or something like that, or you know, I felt a draw, even though I didn't we didn't go to mass all the time. But there was enough in my background of it and reverence for it. And I believe I learned reverence for God a lot in the Catholic Church. Sometimes us Pentecostals are a little casual with God. Mm-hmm. And we need to have the reverence for God. So absolutely, there's some good that you can come. And I draw the good out of stuff. But that'll come out of y'all understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So, you know, to have them just to completely forsake so much, that's powerful, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
A lot of Pharisees, religious leaders willing to give up their careers, mm-hmm, their influence. Remember, Joseph was kind of he wasn't an outspoken, mm-hmm, follower, but when it came to it and he saw his Lord that he believed in die, he was willing to give his grave, yeah, his tomb, and which exposed him.
Mm-hmm.
And one after another did that after Jesus rose. And so they became exposed and they lost that. Remember the man who was healed? And they brought the parents in?
Oh, yeah.
And the parents did not want to get kicked out of the synagogue. Mm-hmm. So they're like, he's an adult. Ask him. Because they said, was he blind from his youth? He's saying that. He's like, yes. Then how do you explain how he sees? He's a grown man, you ask. Because they didn't want to be exposed of saying, because Jesus healed him. And so they cared more about that. So they said, he's a grown man, you ask him. And says because they feared the Jews and didn't want to be kicked out of the synagogue. Imagine these leaders and people that just walked away from that for a non-organized church.
Mm-hmm.
It was a baby, an infant, and grew, and they had to go through the growing stages and everything else. That's just not the disposition. So those are powerful arguments. Here's just an interesting thing. There was an historian by the name of C.B. McCullough that listed 6 tests, so it kind of summarizes some of what we said, to explain the historical facts of the resurrection of Jesus. And it gives the hypothesis that God obviously raised Jesus from the dead. So here they are, 6 points, or 6 tests. It has great explanatory scope, the resurrection. Great explanatory scope. It explains why the tomb was found empty, which we know that was a fact, that it was found empty, why the disciples saw post-mortem appearances of Jesus, and why the Christian faith came into existence. Number 2, it has great explanatory power. It explains why the body of Jesus was gone, why people repeatedly saw Jesus alive despite his earlier public execution and so on. Number 3, it's plausible. We could say it's reasonable, but it's plausible. Given the historical context of Jesus' own unparalleled life and claims, the resurrection serves as divine confirmation of the radical claims that he made. That's what I have ready for tonight, which we'll do next week. Number 4, it's not ad hoc or contrived. It requires only one additional hypothesis, that God exists. And even that needn't be an additional hypothesis if you already believe that God exists. They believed in God. They just had to have one belief, mm-hmm, that God raised Jesus from the dead. So while it was different to their predispositions and beliefs, when it fundamentally comes down to the rubber hitting the road, did God raise Jesus? They weren't forsaking a belief in God. He was the fulfillment of the law, not the annihilation of it. Number 5, in accordance with the accepted beliefs, the hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead doesn't in any way conflict with the accepted belief that people don't naturally rise from the dead. See, we believe God raised Jesus from the dead. So it's supernatural by definition. So when people say, well, people don't rise from the dead, that's why it is a challenge for the non-believer to believe Jesus rose from the dead. But when you just come to the point where it's like, yeah, I believe in God, that's helpful, but that God intervened, the fact that it was unusual. If people were rising from the dead all the time, you wouldn't have a religion for them or anything else. That would have been, you know, something that's happened. No big deal. But God raised him from the dead. That's where we go. How did it happen? God raised him.
Yes.
The Christian accepts the belief wholeheartedly and accepts that God raised him from the dead. And then number six, it far outstrips any of its rival hypotheses in meeting the conditions of 1 through 5. Down through history, various alternative explanations have been offered. We've talked about some of those, the swoon theory, the stealing of the body, and so on. They've been offered the conspiracy hypothesis, the apparent death or the swoon hypothesis, the hallucination hypothesis, and so on. We've dealt with that. It's not, those aren't reasonable. And so when you deal with all those, and they're almost universally rejected by contemporary scholarship over the millennia, those arguments have been made. But when reasonable people look at it, like that one that I quoted, even though he was somebody that was against that, he said, these guys believed Jesus appeared to them. They had some experiences. None of the naturalistic hypotheses meet the conditions for the resurrection. So the most plausible conclusion, and this is where you'll find this book that you've ordered, it's very interesting, J. Warner Wallace and Lee Strobel, who was not a policeman, he was a journalist, investigative journalist that was an atheist, was going to disprove Jesus. He's the one that wrote the book, The Case for Christ. And but he went, J. Warner Wallace, set out to disprove and then ended up looking at all the facts and had to honestly come to the conclusion Jesus is the Son of God. He did rise from the dead. Mm-hmm. See, they started with the death, burial, and resurrection. You disprove that, then all of the other Christianity's gone. Mm-hmm. And these are two figures that are now ministers of the gospel. That's so radically changed they are. Both very analytical thinkers. You can listen to their presentations on YouTube. Very brilliant. J. Warner Wallace is just methodical. You know, it's like, wow. So it puts the skeptic in a situation of not having a reasonable thing. So, you know, they'll try to portray it emotionally and say, you're believing in this, you know, yeah. But is it that hard to believe that God, who is omnipotent, and that's what we're going to get into, you know, next week, that God can raise somebody from the dead?
Yeah.
When you look at all the historical evidence for what happened 2,000 years ago, and we've looked at that, it's reasonable. It's plausible. Mm-hmm. It's the most logical to say Jesus did rise from the dead. Mm-hmm. And then as now taking the apologetic part of it, the defense part of it, now that you come to that conclusion, what are you going to do with that information? That's the spiritual aspect. Mm-hmm. If I believe that, I need to do something about that.
Yep.
That makes Jesus' words and what he asks of us really important. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's where we'll accept Jesus. That's what his siblings did. What these religious leaders did, what these religious believers who believed contrary to those kind of things did, and what millions of people over the last 2,000 years have done.
Absolutely.
That evidence of the resurrection, it is reasonable. Does that help you? Okay, question and answer time. Any challenges that you've heard different against the resurrection, you know, or anything like that, you know, you throw out, you know, maybe not directly, but you've heard it in a debate or, you know, on you know, presented by somebody, you know, and even on a television show. How many TV shows are there nowadays that absolutely go after Christianity and our Christian beliefs? It's amazing, you know. Is that Journey Church up there? Oh, I turned it off. So there we go. Oh, I can look in there and see that. Look at my face. That's not pleasant. That's why I want to get camera set up, because, you know, that's not what's about. I'm going to keep this on for question and answers in case somebody comes up. But maybe you saw something on a television show and it's like, what about that? You know this. Like we had last week with Glenna talking about, you know, in cosmology, which is the origin of things, the origin of the universe, that within the body of Christ, that we have two main viewpoints on the creation, believing that God created everything, but there's the young earth and the old earth position. And so sometimes, you know, a question might come up within that we can deal with, you know, or it can be some. And if you have questions that come up that are outside of something that I've taught, you know, throw those out there and we can maybe consider doing that on the Wednesday nights. I'm really in no rush to, like, turn this into an 8-week series. Mm-hmm. You know, Wednesday night, traditionally, you call it Bible study. You know, my calendar, it beeped a little while ago. I don't know why. I guess it's this new phone. It reset to, it's alerting me through thing because I have things that just are in there, you know, on my calendar all the time to fill it. And it says Bible study, Wednesday Bible study, because that's what we think of Wednesday, Sunday service, you know. And so we're studying the Bible. We're going to be studying, you know, deep things, you know, things that will build your faith and confidence, you know, and Wednesday night's ideal. And so I don't care if we do this till Jesus comes, because like cosmology, or, you know, not just cosmology, but like the young earth and the old earth, I'll present to you both, you know, and let you decide for yourself based on the evidence. Because that's what apologetics is. See, these brilliant thinkers that we're talking about, they're not shaken by questions. And 1 Peter 3:15, that's our memory verse, that's our reason for all this, to always be ready to give an answer or a defense, apologia, for what we believe, and do it with respect, you know, and courtesy. That's the believer's life. And it makes us a stronger believer. I'm not going to tell you who it was, and I'm not going to tell you where it was, because I'll let you sort things out, you know. As me studying, you know, I will study things. I don't encourage believers, especially not a non-Wednesday night, you know, more traditionally a more mature believer, more grounded believer. Traditionally, sometimes you have somebody that's not real grounded in the Word on Wednesdays. I'm just saying, generally speaking, the midweek evening person, you know, has grown in the Lord a little bit more oftentimes. I study things that will challenge my faith and even my belief system in my doctrines that I believe in. And I listen to an hour and a half long refutation of former staff members of a major ministry and why they left that ministry and don't believe in that. And listened with interest, listened to their points that they were making, and it didn't shake my faith at all. I could be able to answer that, and I was kind of blessed in it, because a lot of times people with great animosity and hostility go out there and create some of this. They were being interviewed by somebody that believed like they did, and they went into this total non-supernatural anything extreme, you know, they were respectful. But when they were asked questions, she's like, oh, that's interesting, because they didn't attack. They said, no, this person, I'm not going to say what sex they were, this person, they actually do pray over all of the prayer requests, and you know, and they do, you know, sort the money. Yeah, it's a big, important thing. Money's important. They process, but they process it. And if something gets dedicated to the charitable works, they go to the charitable works. And I'm thinking, praise the Lord. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a testimony to the integrity of that ministry. They had a difference of belief. They came to come apart, because that's what happens. And that's what apologetics will do. And it's when we don't do this that that can happen, because they were leaving someone that's a like-minded faith as we are, belief system like we have, which gets challenged within the body of Christ and outside the body of Christ a lot.
Yeah.
It's a bold thing to declare that it's God's will to heal.
Yeah.
And you have people come at you. You know, what do you have answers for that? You know, and people have to deal with that. So it's good for us to be challenged and have to read the scriptures, weigh the scriptures, and determine, are we being unreasonable?